Vladimir Putin is applying pressure from the east, while hundreds of thousands of migrants have entered from the south, and nations that used to be stalwarts of the European Union now seem skeptical about the entire European project. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, what is happening in Europe? Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A fellow at the Hoover Institution here at Stanford, Michael McFaul served from 2012 to 2014 as the United States ambassador to Russia. A speechwriter and advisor to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and former editor-in-chief of National Review magazine, John O'Sullivan is currently the president of the Danube Institute, a think tank in Budapest, and editor of Quadrant magazine in Sydney, Australia. Mike, John, welcome. Russia. Let me quote Peter Hitchens in the London Spectator last year. Quote, "Just for once, let us try this argument with an open mind. Two great land powers face each other. One of these powers, Russia, has, since the end of the Cold War, given up control over 700,000 square miles of territory. The other, the European Union, has gained control over 400,000 of those square miles. That is, with the former Warsaw Pact countries such as Poland and Hungary joining the EU." And Peter Hitchens says, "Which of these powers is expansionary?" Close quote. Mike, we're provoking Putin.
Well, Russia, in my view, because the rules of the game matter, how you expand matters. And it's a very different thing to join the European Union or even to join a military alliance than to annex territory. And let's not confuse those two things. Annexation is something that I thought was not going to be a part of the 21st century. I thought we got rid of that as a practice in international great power politics. Russia has reintroduced it, and it needs to be stopped. It needs to be thwarted.
Well, okay, so here's the
Well, it's worse than annexation, because the deal that was broken here is one which Russia signed along with Great Britain and the United States in the Budapest Agreement. They've torn that up. So this isn't this is as bad as turning up the Locarno Pact, which is the agreement between states in the 20s, and not the imposition of the Versailles Treaty. So it's a very serious thing.
Well, so here's the counter-argument. We have the Crimean port of Sevastopol is the principal Russian naval base in the Black Sea since Catherine the Great. And as for Ukraine, we have no less a figure than Solzhenitsyn. Alexander Solzhenitsyn rejected any notion that Ukraine was a country in its own right. It was Russian, essentially. So, and then we have, if Roosevelt and Churchill couldn't be bothered to stick up for Ukraine in Yalta in February 1945, why should Angela Merkel or Barack Obama need to stick up for Ukraine now? Look, as the Cold War ended, the boundaries got drawn a little bit incorrectly, and there's a readjustment to underlying geopolitical realities taking place. That's all.
Don't the Ukrainians have any say as to whether they or not they're an independent power with the right to decide their own alliances, economic or political? I think they do. Do the Russians have a right to say our security must be protected, and particularly in relation to the Black Sea Fleet? Yes, they do. But those interests were protected under the previous arrangements. And in a sense, that's a pretext, the idea that Russia's threatened by, first of all, not even joining the EU, but Ukraine becoming an associate member of the EU. It's an absurdity. And for him to react as he did, it simply shows he has no respect for international order.
Mike?
I agree.
I knew you.
But I want to elaborate a little bit about that. Because, you know, sometimes in these discussions, it feels a little bit like a risk game to me, right? You know, this is yours, this is yours.
Yes, right.
But that's not the 21st century. That's not the way politics works. That's not the way threats work. Let me just give an example, the concrete example from on Ukraine. So when the EU were having their deliberations with the Ukrainians and about an accession agreement, and I think it's very important to understand, it was the beginning of a process. I think Turkey signed theirs in 1961. They're still not in the EU.
Right.
But it's just the beginning. And I would go over to the foreign ministry and down to the Kremlin, I was still ambassador at the time, and say, you know, this should be good for you. You should want a rich Ukraine. They're actually the people that buy your goods. There aren't many people in the world that buy Russian goods. Ukrainians do. And my argument was always very simple. As long as their trade relations with you don't violate or not violated by this agreement, this should be win-win-win. And the example I used was Canada. Canada, the United States, right?
Right.
Some might say, you know, well, I don't want to get into comparisons of Canada and Ukraine, but at the time, the Canadians were just beginning to have some trade negotiations with the Russians. And my view, I told the Canadians this, I told the Russians, knock yourselves out. As long as you can, whether it's a free trade agreement, you know, down the road, as long as that doesn't violate Canada's obligations with us in NAFTA, it should be good for Russia, good for Canada. That's the way the 21st century is supposed to work, not this kind of, this is my sphere, this is your sphere. Where's the Google sphere? Where's LinkedIn sphere? Like, where, you know, show me on a map how you could, you find where their spheres of influence works. That's just not the way it works.
Okay, so what are they thinking? Let's take Putin. 16 years as a KGB officer. Now, last week in London, this report, Lord Owen issued a report saying that Putin himself probably approved, those are the words in the report, probably approved the killing of dissident Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned.
Yeah.
So he seems to be killing people. He's a former KGB officer. What does he want? Is he trying to rebuild the old czarist? Is he trying to rebuild the old communist empire? Does he want, we know that it's a kleptocracy. He and his associates are presumably stashing money away in Switzerland. Do they want money? Do they want old-fashioned power? What do they think they're doing? What do they think they're doing?
In the sentence, Putin probably ordered the murder of Litvinenko, the word probably is an extremely important diplomatic escape clause. So that in the event that there is some recompense made, it's hard to see what it would be at the minute, nonetheless, Russia can be taken off the terrorist state, so to speak.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, what is he up to? Well, he's up to demonstrating his authority goes anywhere he wishes it to, which is why it's very important that the British government now may be taking a stronger response to Litvinenko than it has been doing for the past decade. And that's very important, but that's just a symptom of the wider problem of a lawless state, which is lawless in many respects and which has to be held to account in order for the rest of us to be able to live safely in our beds.
But why is it, he wants to be a czar. What does he want? You know the man. What does he think he's doing?
I spent time with the man. I don't want to claim I know him, but I've followed his career. I first met him in the spring of 1991, so I've known him for a while. I would say this. Putin wants to make Russia great again. That's his objective. His problem is he's got a very outdated way for achieving that objective. I actually wouldn't mind seeing Russia great. I'm not against that. I would love to see a prosperous, strong, democratic Russia. But the way you would do it, if I were advising him, would be to reform the economy, to expand freedom. Individual freedom will lead to economic freedom. They wanted, his predecessor, Mr. Medvedev, wanted to help facilitate, create the permissive conditions for a Silicon Valley. That was an idea he had. It's called Skolkovo. I'm all for that. But you can't do it the way Putin is exercising power. And even by his own definition, I would say he's not achieving the objectives of making Russia a great power. Even in the last couple of years, by the way, by many different measures, most of them economic, Russia is contracting, not expanding. So by the definition of his own objective, his strategy is not achieving those ends.
Can I just say, surely there are two problems with this. The first is, of course, that Russia, even if it revives, even if it pursues the policies you've been suggesting, becomes a much more prosperous country, it will not become a superpower again. It's not big enough. Secondly,
the economy's not big enough.
Well, not just the economy, but yes, that's right, the economy's not big enough, but the general view of the state. Now, the second thing which is problematic for him is that he and a lot of Russians, the main Russian tradition, has a neo-imperial great Russian mindset. And it can't really live comfortably in the world of Atlantic institutions until it gets rid of that neo-imperial mindset. It's feeling that these other countries, including Ukraine, are not really independent countries.
So hold on to that thought. This to me is the puzzle. of Russian history, you can see a liberal, small l, a liberal impulse going back to the 19th century, which was the czar who, there was a czar who was a reforming czar, and then there was an assassination. And his successor clamped down. I can't remember, Alexander II maybe, is that right? Yeah. Okay, Alexander II. And then 1905, you get a kind of, you get a Duma. The czar is very reluctant to turn over, but he does turn over powers, and it looks as though it's beginning to turn into a modern state. And then the Second World War comes along, and there's a Bolshevik resolution, and then we get 70 years of communism. And at the end of communism, Yeltsin, this Russian figure, stands on top of a tank to defy the coup and stand up for democracy, and the democracy is gone within 5 years or so. Am I getting the timing wrong? It's gone now. So you see that there's a kind of line that you can draw. There's this impulse, this new effort, the effort to shake off the old imperial ways of thinking, and yet they just, why is that? Why can they not shake off? Well, it's 1,000 years of history. It's not easy to shake off. But why can't Russia catch a break?
Well, so you're pointing to a debate that's, as you alluded to, the debate between Slavophiles and the Westerners that goes back to the 19th century. And I think it's important to note that the neo-imperial impulse that John described and this liberal impulse both exist in Russia. So it's not, it's improper. When people say Russia thinks that, Russia thinks this, when I was ambassador, I wouldn't let people write that in cables. It's like, you know, introduce me to Mr. Russia. I've never met him. There's a multitude of views. What's happened in the last, and to your point, just to emphasize, at the end of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev had the, you know, moments when he could have gone in an imperial way, he chose not to. And then Yeltsin chose not to. So individuals had different ideas and went one way or the other. At the end of Yeltsin's time even, right, we all think that somehow Putin was chosen from God and came down to save Russia. That's kind of a narrative. That's his view. But in fact, he was chosen by Boris Yeltsin, picked out of the blue, mostly to protect the property rights of the Yeltsin family. That was the main consideration. Had he picked somebody else, just Boris Nemtsov, another liberal, who was a deputy prime minister around the time that Yeltsin actually really liked, the history could have been very different. So I don't think this is all preordained by history or culture. I mean, those things in geography affect it. But I do think individuals and these ideas matter. Putin, however, is in power. Putin has those views. They were latent for a while, and now he expresses them openly. And those with the liberal ideas, people that would feel very comfortable hanging out here at the Hoover Institution, they're in Russia. I know those people. I know them well.
They exist. The impulse is still alive.
Well, they're just on the margins right
now. Okay, so I'd like to go elsewhere in Europe, so let's close out Russia. What a thing to say, 1,000 years of history. Let's be done with it. Next president of the United States, what's your advice? Look. Wait Putin out, let the Germans continue to handle the problem in Ukraine. What's your advice to the next president of the United States?
A version of containment, which is to say that punish Russia when they do things that violate international laws and treaties and norms. Sanctions, as the European Union and the United States have done together. Strengthen NATO. Diminish any doubt in Putin's mind that we will defend all NATO allies, including those that share a border with Russia.
You're not talking about rolling back the annexation of Crimea, though, are you?
No, I didn't say that. Okay. But third, help Ukraine. The most important event in the next 2 years is whether or not the reforms, political and economic, in Ukraine succeed. If they succeed, that will be a greater pushback to Putin than any other thing we can do. So those three things are the main thing. And one candidate has already, Mr. Trump, has already said, well, if I get elected, I'm just going to be friendly with Putin. That's exactly the wrong thing you would do.
I broadly agree with your list of policies to pursue. I would stress one. Helping Ukraine can have this very useful effect. In effect, I mean, what's happening here is Ukraine is now divided. if with the Americans and the Europeans combined to give real assistance to the Ukrainian reforms and money, you can develop an East Germany, West Germany division in about 10 years. And I would personally leave all of the funding that was necessary for the statelet that's under Putin's control to be paid for by Moscow. I don't think there should be any kind of payments coming from Kiev. And at the end of that period, everyone will look at these two countries as they looked for many years at the two Germanies, and they will say, well, we know which set of policies work, and we know, as happened, that all of these dependencies became burdens to the Soviet Union. And so, equally, there'll be a point at which some rational Russian leader will say, we've got to get out of this situation, and that's the policy I think I would pursue.
All right. Hungary and Poland. Since 2010, Viktor Orban has been Prime Minister of Hungary and leader of the ruling party that I cannot pronounce, Fidesz. By far the most popular party in Hungary, with two-thirds of the seats in the national parliament. Poland. In October of last year, the conservative Law and Order Party, conservative is what the press over here calls it. It's odd in any event. We'll call it that. The conservative Law and Order Party won parliamentary elections so soundly that it became the first party to rule Poland by itself, no coalition partners, since the fall of communism. The Economist magazine, quote, "The new government of Poland has defied the European Union's warnings, pushing through laws that critics see as weakening constitutional checks and balances and media freedom. Centrists and liberals warn of Orbanization, fearing that Poland is following the illiberal path of Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister," close quote. John?
Well, I think I'm probably going to disagree on this one with Michael, but it seems to me the story here is this. For the first 20 years after 1989, the left still existed in the politics of these countries. You had socialist and post-communist parties. They have vanished now in Poland and in Hungary. They just don't get enough votes. Now, what has that meant? Well, in Poland particularly, to a lesser extent in Hungary, that has meant that you have a kind of a Whig and Tory, and the Whigs being the urban party, economically liberal, skeptical about welfare, very pro-EU, pro-Euro in principle, and secondly, the Tory, the country party, more religious, less urban, skeptical about free market policies, willing to pay for welfare. And that's now the division. Now, you have the same thing in a slightly different format in Hungary. I think this is perfectly healthy and reflects the failure of the old left to be able to do anything, offer anything to these countries. I happen to think, and no doubt this will emerge, that some of the stories you get in The Economist and elsewhere are extremely biased. Let me give you one example. The argument that the new Polish government is attempting to neuter the Constitutional Court, that argument, we get the reporting of that in the middle of the argument. It doesn't make any attention to the fact that having lost an election, the previous quasi-liberal government, actually, they're the people who appointed a whole series of judges with the express intention of making sure that the new government couldn't carry through its policies. The president, who was a member of the conservative side, he simply didn't accept this, and that's where that argument goes back to. Now, there are a lot of things like that. I can cite similar ways in which the argument in Hungary is only half the argument. You hear, it's like hearing an argument in which every time one guy speaks, the sound goes off.
Happens in Russia, doesn't it?
I rest my case.
Mike had microphones turned off on him all the time. Do you have a view on Poland and Hungary?
Yes. I don't know the details as well as you do, and I think it's really interesting what you said about the disappearance of the left, because that was true in the early days. That was considered an asset for their transitions, right? That they had these social democratic parties, and that was always a problem in Russia and other places where they had the old stalwart Communist Party. But now that's gone. This is a big change. You know, my view is, the rules of the game are what are important about democracy, not the policy debates. And as long as the basic democratic rules of the game are not violated, that's what everybody should keep their eye on the ball about. And number two, I would just remind, it's an obvious thing, but these are rather new democracies.
Right.
If you look around comparatively, I teach a course on comparative democratization here at Stanford. you'll find that most new democracies struggle. It's our democracy, after all, struggled. Our democracy, after all, broke down into a civil war. I'm not predicting that for these countries, but we shouldn't overreact that this early in the phase that they're having these growing pains. And at the same time, we should keep focused on them, make sure that the rules of the game are not violated. For me, I'm more worried about the geopolitics of it. Right. I worry about the divisions within these countries, a move away from EU solidarity against Russia. But we'll come back to that.
No, just hold that thought.
I'm not in agreement with that.
One detail that strikes me as very telling. The new government in Poland has eliminated the European Union flag from press conferences. So the prime minister and the president give their press conferences, and it used to be, here's the Polish flag, here's the EU flag. Now they do so in front of the Polish flag. Significant?
Yes, it is significant, as a matter of fact. I mean, whether or not you agree or not, don't. And let me give you an example which makes the point even more clearly. If you had been following the election campaign in Hungary last year, and you'd gone to a government Fidesz party rally, they would have been waving the Hungarian flag. If you went to the socialist rally, they were still a substantial party, they were waving the European Union flag. That's partly because there is now, within all of these countries, a disposition and an argument about the EU. Do you want to commit yourself fully to the EU, or do you want to remain independent, quasi-independent, somewhat skeptical, angry about EU intervention? And that's a right-left decision, a right-left division, which is beginning to seriously influence politics in, I would say, everywhere in Europe, actually. Yep. It's happening in Mediterranean Europe, too.
That's not just a Hungarian or Polish debate. That's a debate throughout the continent.
Okay, so let's continue then. Germany. Last year, Germany admitted more than 1 million asylum seekers, that's the term they seem to be using, from the Middle East and North Africa, overwhelmingly Muslim. We know that most of them are young, in their 20s and younger, and most of them are male. And early this year, Chancellor Angela Merkel has already rejected a call to cap the new number of immigrants that Germany will admit in 2016. Ross Douthat of the New York Times, this is the longest quotation, but it's still an economical way of covering a lot of ground. Here we go. The issue isn't just that immigrants are arriving in the hundreds of thousands, it's that a huge proportion of them are teenage and 20-something men. The German 20-something population was less than 10 million in 2013, already included many immigrants. In that cohort and every cohort afterward, the current influx could have a transformative effect, pushing Germany toward a future in which half the under 40 population would consist of Middle Eastern and North African immigrants and their children. Here's how the quotation gets closed. If you believe that Germany is likely peacefully to absorb a migration of that scale and size, then you are a fool. Close quote. John?
If you believe that, you are certainly imprudent. There is no doubt about that.
All right.
For example, you're imprudent on national security grounds, as we've seen from the murders in Paris and elsewhere. You are imprudent on social cohesion grounds, as we've seen. You are in Cologne and elsewhere with the women being attacked. You are imprudent on grounds of importing anti-Semitism and now a Sunni Shia civil war into your society. And all of these imprudences are very dangerous, and what makes them still more dangerous is that in the past, when we've talked about bringing refugees and asylum seekers in, we've been thinking in terms of relatively clear numbers. But now, unless you're confining them to a particular crisis, there is a potential pool of billions of people who might come in. And one of the causes of immigration is previous immigration. People go to countries where people like them from their societies are already situated, so they will have friends and some way of arriving in the society without being completely confused. So this is a very dangerous situation, and the Germans have only begun to cope with it.
And to you in a moment, Mike, Angela Merkel has been Chancellor of Germany for a generation, for 2005, I think, she first became chancellor. So 15 years, that's a generation. You look skeptically at me, you've caused me to do math in my mind, now I'm worn
out.
And for all of this time, she's been very careful, a bit of a trimmer, calculator, this way, that way, making sure she had the country with her before she moved in this direction. And here she is saying, no, We're going to let a million of them in.
Do you really think that? For example, her decision to get rid of the nuclear energy program overnight in response to the problems in Japan, do you think that was a rational thing to do? Particularly when you've committed yourself to a dramatic downsizing of the use of carbon. So you're not going to have oil and gas and coal-fired generating stations, and you're not going to have nuclear. So what's going to happen? Well, the answer is the bills for the consumer, energy bills for the consumer and for German industry are going to rise dramatically in comparison with their competitors, particularly America, and there's going to be hell to pay.
Mike, Germany, would you care to stick up for Angela Merkel?
Well, for the issues I know better, she's been a very valuable ally to the United States, and I think an important leader in Europe for standing up to Putin. I mean, without her, we would not have had the sanctions we had against Russia in 2014, the most comprehensive sanctions against Russia probably in history. At least you got to go back farther on American history for sure. I don't know of a time in European history where you had such comprehensive set of sanctions. So I think she plays a very important role in terms of how to deal with that problem. But what I'm struck by more as an observer than an expert is just the multitude of major challenges that she's facing and the EU as a whole is facing.
Putin coming in, Putin putting pressure on from the East. She's got a million immigrants arriving last year. And it turns out our friend Joe Jaffe, who editor of Die Zeit, so far this year, they're on pace for exactly the same number, about 1.2 million this year again.
That's incredible.
The euro situation still has not been addressed. And then something we'll come to next, you've got Britain attempting to renegotiate its terms of its obligations to the EU and thinking about withdrawing altogether. That's all. So is that too much for Europe to handle? Do you have the feeling that that continent is undergoing, there's a kind of pressure, a shock here, a shock there, that makes you worried? You're a professional diplomat.
Well, of course it makes me worried, because we need the transatlantic partnership for our own interests, speaking as an American. And the dissolution, the more parochial policies, the splits that Putin might do in terms of peeling off the consensus, that's all bad in terms of, in my view, for American national interests. I don't live in Europe. I want to hear what you have to say, but it feels from afar that this is one of the most troubling times you've had in terms of the European Union. I mean, I actually remember sitting in this room with Milton Friedman talking about the euro. Maybe you were with us, Peter. And he said, from his point of view, this just makes no economic sense, this single currency. And at the time, this is 20 years ago or maybe 15 years ago, I thought, well, what do you mean? It's been done. It's a political decision. Now I think back to that time and I worry that maybe Milton Friedman was right.
Yes. Well, I think Milton was actually. And I would just add to the list of sins of Angela Merkel that she, by her wooden insistence on retaining the status quo, is dooming Mediterranean Europe to high levels of unemployment and low growth, well, for the last 7 or 8 years, and I think well into the future. But I don't disagree with what Michael said. In fact, I agree about the Ukraine crisis and the maintenance of sanctions. I think that is true. Now, on Britain, you see, I think that the idea that American has dominated American politics since really 1950s is that Britain, as a member of the European Union, will be a solid pro-American influence, prevent them going off to protectionist policies, anchor them in NATO and so on. And I think that may have been true in the Cold War. I think it is increasingly proved to be untrue and that people should really stand back a little. I think that if Britain...
People meaning Americans.
Americans, but also everybody else too. I mean, I think the British are not comfortable and will never be comfortable within the EU. It will not be solved by a decision to stay in. What would be better would be for Britain to remove itself and pursue its own policies, not in defense, because NATO is the key there, but allowing the rest of the EU to proceed towards closer integration without the Brits every 10 minutes raising their hands and saying, I'm sorry, we don't agree with that. Now, that's the policy I think we should begin to move towards. We may be forced to move towards it by the British voters, but whether or not we are, we should stop. We should now have Brexit in our sights and have contingency plans for that happening.
Brexit is British exit.
British exit.
So, as I understand it, it is the declared policy of the United States and has been since the end of the Second World War to support continuing integration, political, economic, but also political, under the European Union. I'm asking this question of a professional diplomat, well, you, man who served,
former,
somebody who knows more about it than I do. So that's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
That is correct, there's no doubt. So is it time to change American policy?
You know, this is going to be a set of issues where American policy is just going to react to what happens
with
voters in Britain. I don't think a declared policy from the United States one way or the other would be appropriate. I do think your point about contingency planning, though, is very important, because it's simply not something, to be honest, you know, as I think about the policy debates when I was at the White House,
that
senior foreign policymakers were thinking of the probabilities of it, right? We were consumed with other problems. We were consumed with Afghanistan and Iraq and terrorism. This one was kind of done. The European Directorate at the NSC, that was always the place for maintaining the alliance on these other issues, not thinking about it as a subject matter that we had to be concerned with, including, by the way, I think we need to say, European security. I was at the NATO summit in 2010. Mm-hmm. That was a summit, it was in Lisbon, when we thought European security was a done deal, it was over. We needed to think about how to use the NATO alliance in other places, because that was the challenge both for our security and the challenge to give NATO a new mandate. That proved to be premature as well.
Yes. I was one of the people who founded the New Atlantic Initiative, and that was exactly our aim, to try to move in that direction. And I think we went a long way towards it, but as you say, it's been stalled.
You may both think I'm crazy. For all I know, you both think I'm crazy as it is. But let me go back to, as I recall, it was the early 1990s, maybe it was the late 80s, Irving Kristol wrote a series of columns in the Wall Street Journal in which he said, we really need to wrap up NATO. And here's why. By the 1970s, the Europeans had not only recovered from the Second World War, but become, broadly speaking, as wealthy as the United States. Yet the United States had continued to shoulder overwhelmingly the burden of defense. Bigger defense establishment, far more spending. The Europeans were free riding on it. You could hardly find a nation in Europe that's spending the proportion of GDP that the NATO agreement calls for on defense. So, and Britain couldn't mount an expeditionary force to the Falklands today. Britain has no aircraft. The Royal Navy has no aircraft carrier. Okay, and Irving Kristol said, we run the risk of infantilizing these nations, and indeed the European Union, that self-defense is a simple matter of self-respect as a nation, and this is going to lead to trouble. Was he right? Is there something to that?
You know, the argument's better than I.
Well, I mean, I remember that very well, Irving wrote. And,
oh, you do remember? Because I'm vague on it. Good.
Irving was a conservative, not a neoconservative. That's a very unconservative position, because NATO is actually the structure that maintains peace at the moment. Not as well as we would like, as we've been discussing, but nonetheless it does. It should have more money spent on it by other than Americans. We've got to get that. I believe here that Mr. Putin may have come to our assistance. We should play up the threat in order to compel the other members of NATO to spend more, and to combine in all kinds of ways more effectively. That also means, in my view, which you may disagree with here, but which is that we should discourage the Europeans from proceeding with a European defense identity. In my view, it's always been a bad idea, and it's a fraud, because it can't do anything unless the Americans are prepared to actually move the troops from here to there and provide them with the necessary cover. So it's a fraud, it costs money, it duplicates ideas. Why? Why do it? And I would say that's part of the solution.
I'll give you another example. I just attacked the Royal Navy. Oh. Hollande, after the terrorist attacks in Paris, big speech in the National Assembly, French National Assembly, France is going to attack ISIS. And France did attack ISIS. Seven jets. That's how many they were able to deploy in this huge moment of national fury when vengeance on these terrorists was seven jets. Pathetic!
Well, you're absolutely right. And I will just say simply that the British government, which I'm very critical of in lots of ways, is actually now increasing its defense spending. Not as much as I would like, but it's doing so. And it has a fairly good defense minister. But having said that, I think an American should pronounce here.
Well, NATO is necessary. NATO atrophied for many years along the lines you said. And now because of Putin, everybody in the alliance should realize why it's necessary and you know, take care of those kinds of, you know, everybody has to get to at least to 2%. And I think that imperative, which was an argument not going anywhere for many years, is now back on the table. Of course, that's right. But the other piece is also about America, because there are some that say, well, we shouldn't be involved. And I think, especially with Putin involved, with no disrespect to some of our other allies, but when Putin's thinking about whether to invade Estonia or not, having the United States as part of the alliance is a very important piece of deterrence.
Okay, can I ask another? Here's another sort of deep thinking question. In other words, it's not a question of policy this minute. But here's a question. Actually, I accuse you in a certain sense, and Mike may chortle as two conservatives. But conservatives say over and over and over again, large aspects of human endeavor are self-organizing. We need less government involvement in the economy because the economy will organize itself. You'll have entrepreneurs forming. All right. Labor will shift where it's needed and so forth. And we make this argument everywhere except in Europe, where we need more of the United States and more. If we pulled out, why wouldn't Europe be self-organized? There would be some difficulties. They'd jostle around. But they sorted things out that lasted for a century after the Napoleonic Wars. They figured out how to...
It broke down.
Well, then it did break down. So why? What? It is in their interest. It is in the Europeans' interest. It's in Poland's interest and Germany's interest that Vladimir Putin not take Estonia. And they're rich countries. They're richer than Russia. Why can't they handle that problem themselves?
Because, Peter, I don't know the survey data. I don't have it in front of me. But if I were living in Estonia, where I was recently, I'd be worried that the French want to go to war with Russia to defend Estonia. I'm not sure. I would be worried that the German people would say, oh, it was part of... Yeah, I mean, in other words, it's not self-evident.
You don't trust them.
Well, the Estonians don't trust them. That's what I worry more about. That they're in the alliance, and so the idea that somehow it'll all be worked out without the United States, maybe in the future, but not now.
But also for this reason, what created the peace in Europe was the presence of America as a European power after 1945. This meant that no European country could hope to gain anything from waging war or anything else on its neighbors. The Americans wouldn't allow it. Now, there's no power in Europe that can do that. You think Germany? No. Germany is simply not big enough on its own to be able to enforce itself in Europe. And by the way, its demographics are poor. And if they solve their demographic problem by importing millions of people from the Middle East, that won't improve them in other ways. So essentially, the EU exists because of American pacification carried out by America. And if America withdraws, you're creating a giant big question mark on the future for all of Europe.
So can you hold on? You agree with this in general?
Yep.
Okay,
course.
Terrific.
Yep.
So you both will remember the 50th anniversary of the EU, which took place, what, 6-7 years ago? And
I'm not sure I remember.
Oh, you don't? Well, you're so young.
No, I just don't. Was it a big event? I wasn't thinking.
Well, it was a big enough event for me, actually, to read some of the speeches that were given.
I apologize.
And one European after another stood up and congratulated themselves on having transcended the need for force. They had discovered a new way to exist, and it was the way of diplomacy and goodwill. They had become fantasists. NATO never got mentioned. The reason there was peace in Europe for 50 years was not because they had invented a new way to exist, but because the United States of America kept troops in Europe and aircraft carriers in the Baltic. Well, maybe they wouldn't, but you get the point.
Yes.
And they had become exactly what Irving would have predicted, fantasists. And that's dangerous.
It is dangerous, but it's not going to be solved by simply throwing out the present structure of security and hoping that something will emerge.
Well, it will eventually, John.
But I would put a caveat on that. I think I know the spirit in that. I think the argument that, I don't know the exact speeches, but the argument that You know, what are the probabilities that Germany and France are going to go to war today? Very low. And that's not, NATO helped to create the permissive conditions for that, but now that's very low. What they got wrong was they forgot about the external threats to Europe. There are not all European countries are democracies. Not all European countries are integrated in the same way. And that was the part that I think that was the euphoric moment, that there were no more threats, and that turned out to be premature.
Okay. And may I say,
yes,
there's
may.
One other thing.
John, you may say
which
anything.
Which is that there is another division in Europe, the division on the nation state between the elites and the people. The editor of the American Interest was recently in Germany. He met all the senior figures, Adam Garfinkel. He came away amazed that they thought there was no risk in a sense, abolishing the nation state with massive immigration. And furthermore, he found that the entire German elite really thought that a desire to live in a society which in some sense reflects you, your personality, the way you are, was an immoral attitude. And consequently, you know, you now have a divide between people governing the whole of Europe who are trying to abolish nation states and the people in them who, by and large, are perfectly happy with the nation state.
What do you do about that, Ambassador?
I think that's the struggle of the next 10 to 20 years. I think we thought it was resolved, and it's not.
So we should side with the common man?
Personally, I would, yes, but that's not the common view.
All right.
There's somewhere in between.
Somewhere, okay.
Right?
So in between. I'm getting wild signals from, because I'm indulging myself, because it's such a pleasure to have the two of you here together. So one question about Russia, the importance for American engagement. But is it not the case that your man, President Obama, whom you chose to serve, has delegated responsibility for Ukraine to Angela Merkel?
No.
No? All right, defend him. Defend him.
Well, it's just not the policy. I mean, the policy was sanctions from the United States and Europe. Without the Americans involved, there would not have been the sanctions against Putin's cronies and those companies. Reinforcing NATO. That's the policy of the Obama administration. It wouldn't have happened.
We beefed up a presence in the Baltic, I think.
And not only, and hopefully there'll be more at the coming summit. That required the Americans to be involved. By the way, the entire Obama administration, not just President Obama, but without American engagement, that wouldn't have happened. And even on Ukraine, I think there the actual money is coming from the IMF, although the Americans have a great deal of say over what happens at the IMF.
Right.
Former colleague of mine is at the White House, is now the number two at the IMF. His name's David Lipton, and David knows Ukraine well, and has without his leadership, I'm not sure you would have got the package you got. But there I would say the Americans need to do more. That is the piece where I think there's not enough attention. I agree entirely with what you said 20 minutes earlier, that the big fight over the next couple of years in terms of the battle between Putin and Europe is about whether Ukraine succeeds or fail, and we need to lean into that fight.
All right. When one guest says up to another guest, I agree with something you said 20 minutes ago, the show's running a little long, so
I'm in trouble.
So let me know you.
Yes.
No. So look, a little bit about current politics. Who among the presidential candidates seems to you to have the best grasp of foreign policy? Are you going to say Hillary Clinton? You worked with her, right?
Yeah, I know Secretary Clinton well. My view is that she would be the kind of leader we need in terms of foreign policy. I think there are others on the Republican side too, but I'll tell you honestly, I'm very worried about Mr. Trump.
Trump with regard to foreign policy.
Yeah. This is not a partisan. This is a statement as an American who believes in engagement, who believes in American leadership. Whether you're Democrat or Republican, some of the things he says just don't fit with what I think has been a lot of consensus over the last 70 years, and that scares me.
But Mike, that's just because you're making the mistake of supposing he means anything he says.
No, what
about Bernie Sanders?
I don't see credentials. Let me be honest. I don't know much about Bernie Sanders. I'm not following these things as closely, maybe, as I should.
Is in a category of his own as someone who would really be unacceptable, you reckon?
Well, just some of the things he says are just outrageous, outlandish. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe we don't need to believe them. But, well, you know everything. You know what he says about the Chinese and the Mexicans, and it just if any of that was to become U.S. policy, I think we'd be in a world of trouble.
John,
I think Donald Trump is an unguided missile. I also think that anybody who becomes president arrives in a situation in which he gets a lot of administrative yes. help on determining what the real options are.
Right.
And I have no reason to believe he's completely stupid. I yes. do think, therefore, that you know we're being over anxious about that. He wouldn't be my first candidate by a long chalk.
I do like the bumper sticker, Trump. He's not completely stupid.
Well,
all right.
But what he represents, it seems to me, the anger he represents at the failure of American government to achieve certain things or deal with certain anxieties is important.
And valid.
And therefore, anyone who and whoever runs the Republican Party, whoever is the candidate, I think they have to take on board those anxieties and deal with them, not necessarily exactly as he would. Although, by the way, on the question of immigration, I think what he says is more right than wrong.
Is there anybody you would rule out? Mike Singles, Trump is in a category on his own with Mike.
Well, at least what he says. I think John raises a very important point about what I experienced on day one working as a U.S. government official. The national security apparatus is there.
Right.
When it's one thing to be out, and this is true of Democrats and Republicans, they say some pretty crazy things.
Yeah.
But when you're sitting in the Oval Office and having to think about war and peace, suddenly, you're going to listen to those generals.
That's a weak argument.
Trump
won't be that bad because the bureaucracy will tie him up.
But on the other side of that
doesn't
argument...
Doesn't mean I want him to be president.
No, right.
But there's another side of that argument.
Yes,
I think those candidates, Marco Rubio is a good example, who have been presenting a much more interventionist activist policy, Well, I think the problem for that is the American people have probably decided that they don't want to wage another unwinnable war.
Whatever happens, not another Iraq.
Absolutely. We can't possibly lose. So if we're going to engage anywhere, we have to be absolutely certain we can win and we know how to do it. And that, I think, is actually the middle position that the American people are in. And I think it's a perfectly rational one.
All right.
I totally agree.
Gentlemen, I'm enjoying myself, but the producer's over here jumping up and down.
I got to go see Condi
Ambassador,
Rice.
McFaul, John O'Sullivan, thank you. For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.